Hi, I'm William Tullett from Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge.
And I'm Hannah McCann from the University of Melbourne in Australia.
And welcome to the Pandemic Sensory Archive, a collection of voices from sensory experts on the fate of the five senses during and after the COVID-19 pandemic.
This project has been sponsored by the British Academy, and we hope that you enjoy the interview. So just to get started, do you want to introduce yourself and give us a sense of your expertise when it comes to sound?
Sure. So my name is Shoshana Rosenberg. I am currently living and working on the land of the Wurundjeri people, the Kulin Nation. I've been a musician for, it's actually going to be 20 years this year. And you know, gigging for just under 20 years and, you know, started with lots of, you know, was in lots of punk bands and hardcore bands and metal bands and stuff like that. On top of that, I've also, you know, in more recent years, I've started a kind of focusing much more on my kind of solo practice. So mainly, I mainly do like either bass clarinet performances or kind of like improvised like electronics performances. I write about queerness and sound. I also write about queerness and transness kind of more broadly and through other things. So I'm a trans health researcher as well. But sound and kind of sonics and sort of people's relationships to that kind of like are constantly kind of playing a part in how I'm thinking about stuff and how I process things also. So that's kind of my background.
Yeah, so interesting. So many different aspects to sound there, like the actual performance, but then theorizing it in terms of all these other kind of aspects of identity.
Exactly. Yeah.
Can you talk us through kind of your style of performances? You mentioned bass, clarinet, and electronic music.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm an ex-punk, as I like to say. And the emphasis on X, I really have like exited that kind of realm. Mostly a lot of my performances these days are kind of focused on, so everything's improvised. I will write kind of like little segments or I'll think of kind of like little sections or something. But most of the time I really focus on improvisation and that's, you know, for kind of two reasons. Hold on. You want the window down?
You're gonna have to edit this, sweetie. I'm really sorry.
Thank you.
Here you go.
Look, this is just, and this is what happens when you interview ex-punks. You get shit like doing interviews in cars. I guess my focus has become really on improvisation, both because I'm not trained in any way. I never did music at school. I've never done a music, like, I never did a music degree, heaven forbid, or anything like that. So it's kind of a combination of, it's one of those things where it's almost kind of a refusal of proficiency in some way, or like a refusal of technicality. And I've played in some pretty like technical and fast and like intense bands, but so much of it for me is like always been about like kind of what my experience is in any given moment, and then also what's the audience's experience at any given moment. And I feel like I've really landed at a point where improvisation really lends itself to, it's quite conducive to how I like to do things. It's quite conducive to my kind of, I don't want to talk about it in terms of like goals because that seems quite didactic, but I suppose I do love creating spaces and moments, and if I can help it, if I find the right fingering, like, you know, melodies or whatever that are as much about me being immersed in what I'm doing as it is kind of like an invitation for others to also be immersed in it, which obviously can happen with any kind of music, but I personally really find that improvisation and slowness and repetition are all these kinds of things where like you're kind of given permission to just sink into it instead of having to like hyper focus or, you know, a song starting and stopping and starting and stopping. You know, I'm really quite interested in the sort of flow and immersiveness of things. And again, regardless of whether I'm playing bass clarinet or doing doing electronics or, you know, doing weird voice performances with people, or someone hands me a drum and I gotta bang it for like half an hour, like whatever it is, like my interest is ultimately using improvisation as a kind of framework to free myself to like justify the fact that I can't read music, but also to free myself from doing anything except whatever is just happening, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's very much about the moment for me, I would say.
Wow. I mean, it sounds terrifying to me if I was
absolutely
before.
But you know what? You know what's more terrifying? Writing an extremely fucking technical, like 7 minute song and fucking it up 4 minutes and losing it. Like, I'd rather like make a bung note and then be like, okay, well, how does that fit into the thread that I've been tying? Do I continue with it? Do I move away from it? Do I include it? You know, do I, you know, which has happened to me before. I feel like I've definitely like made sounds on stage that I've like cracked up at, or like had a kind of like, you know, kind of really obvious response to. And to me, that's much less scary and much more freeing in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, tell me how it works with like picking up on the feeling in the room and working with that. I mean, is it about listening really intently, or is it some other skill?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because I think that in some ways and you know, this is partly my neurodivergence and my kind of lived experience and you know, a lot of different, you know, even my culture, like my Jewishness and all that kind of playing into it. But like, in a lot of ways, I think that how I view myself in some ways, or how I understand, like, especially live performances, but actually any kind of like sonic output, is kind of like leading by example. So my eyes are shut when I play bass clarinet shows, you know, my eyes are shut. I'm sitting in place. And it's kind of like, it's this sort of almost like body mirroring kind of thing, you know, speaking of like, you know, you mentioned before we started recording about like talking about like that I can talk about all the senses, and to me it's like the sight, actually, you know. And I'm 6'4", I'm huge, I have a presence anyway, and I think that there's something quite, again, permissive, but also kind of like I don't know, like disarming about you know, a strangely huge, heavily tattooed person playing very, very long notes, very, very slowly for a very, very long time. It's like, okay, right, this is so specific. And like, I have no template for this performance and what I meant to do with it. I guess I just got to like ease into it. And that's kind of been the most of the feedback that I've received about both my performances and my albums and stuff. And, you know, and I used to do the same thing in terms of like body doubling, I suppose, when I was in punk bands, except that was body doubling like, I'm going to headbang twice as hard as any of you can, but I encourage you to like try as hard as you can to join me in that kind of like high energy sort of thing. So now it's about not necessarily low energy, but certainly slow, slow kind of energy. And yeah, there's an invitation there, right? Like, I feel like I go through life both within Sonics, but also broader than Sonics, and try to invite other people into my world in a variety of ways, you know, whether it is inviting them into what my body is looking like, or even inviting them into, you know, considering their gender, thinking about queerness, thinking about like kind of Jewishness, you know, like all these kinds of things that I find that time and time again, because my approach is one of sharing, that kind of tends to manifest in how people experience my performances and how I experience my performances too. Because I do look around at the crowd and go, right, okay, who am I playing to, like, actually in terms of people and, you know, like in terms of like the space that I'm in, but then also, and now you get to have this thing that is me, like, injected into this situation, and like, do what thou wilt with it, essentially.
I mean, I listened to some of the recordings, and we can link people on the website.
Cool.
Some of them reminded me of like film scores or something. And I wondered if that was because you were playing them you know, in the same way that someone recording a film score would be kind of responding to the action of a film, it's like you're responding to the action of the room.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the very first things that I learned, in fact, I believe the very first thing that I learned to play ever, but like I bought myself a clarinet when I was 26. Like I didn't start playing until I was in my like mid to late 20s. And I'm pretty sure the very first thing that I played was like a piece from like Angelo Badalamenti's score for Twin Peaks, like specifically the forest theme, the really slow, like kind of forest theme.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, you know, in some ways it is for me about like filling a space. Actually, I love filling a space. And that means that you got to like figure out what the nooks and crannies are, right? Like you got to figure out what the shape of the space is, both the like architectural, but also the like human or the like psychological shape of the space. And like, yeah, there is a responsiveness to it that I find quite appealing. I do love film scores. And again, particularly film scores that are responsive. I was very privileged to actually write a film score for a friend a few years ago, like a live film score for one of their movies. And it was really nice. It was really nice to be like, okay, and now my body's got to do this because this is what's happening. This is what the body on screen is doing, or this is what the landscape on screen is doing, you know? And like really kind of force myself to think about it and feel it and know what's right and what's not working quite so well in those kind of spaces.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And I mean, there's so much discussion here in terms of space and, you know, the audiences that are receiving this sound and part of that soundscape. And it makes me think about pandemic times and how that's changed. I mean, like what have your experiences been of creating music during the pandemic and how it's affected that whole reception process?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because, and I've been reflecting on it since you asked me to participate in this. And I kind of realized that I, you know, sort of related, but sort of unrelated to the pandemic. So in my kind of circles that I travel in, probably about 2 weeks into the first lockdown last year, an absolute pillar of the experimental music scene in Melbourne, Sean Baxter, passed away. And it was just one of those things that it really forced me to take a step back. Actually, it really made me kind of, you know, aside from the fact that of course like venues were closed and live performance was dead for all intents and purposes for at least for a period of time, but like I guess it actually was one of those like really intense highlights of like how personal my sound practice is to me, like how personal, how intimate, and how kind of like relational actually my sort of like experience, my experience of sound and sound making is like, you know, it's actually not for me. And in some ways it is always facilitated by whatever or whoever is around me. Unfortunately with Sean's passing away, you know, that made an impact on everyone, like everyone that was involved in Naked Up Club, everyone that was involved in experimental music more broadly. But it sort of did tie into this kind of lockdown as well. It was like, okay, well, right, like what even is intimacy anymore? What does intimacy look like in this kind of situation, you know, in the kind of headspace that you're sort of forced into, I suppose, in some ways. And it took me a really long time to scrape myself back from that. You know, I found myself like I did not perform. I performed once and it was on an Instagram live feed and it was atrocious and maybe the least satisfied I have ever been with making tooting sounds in front of people. like really, really, truly. I really had to take a step back because for me, it's not, you know, I'm not like, I make albums, but I'm not a studio artist. I'm not actually interested in making albums that aren't then going to be something that I touch upon live, that I touch upon in front of people, that I can even like have like, you know, because it's as much about the performance as it is about like the conversations that happen after the performance for me. And I had none of that really, none of that to speak of. So yeah, it's somewhere between like lack of access to intimacy and actually like a radical reformation of what it means to be intimate and close and producing in intimacy and closeness in you know, in whatever it is that I do, including writing, including everything that I've done. You know, I did a lecture for the first time like 3 months ago, like a live in front of people lecture for the first time 3 months ago. I'd taken like more than a year off from that, which used to be a very regular thing for me. So yeah, it's just been one of those things where, yeah, the pandemic kind of spelled out that intimacy is fragile and both valuable and fragile, and that relationship and that ratio is something that you're kind of always having to toss up actually, and to kind of really think about.
I mean, I'm so fascinated to hear from someone that did one of those Instagram live performances.
Yeah.
Because I watched some and I just thought, gosh, this must be so weird for the performer. You know, I really enjoyed them, but myself, but you know, the difference between kind of playing to your phone in your lounge room versus the usual feedback you would get as a performer must be profound. Like, I can't imagine.
Yeah. And you know, it's like, I guess some people might think about that as this like interesting bridge between like your private space and like the world. But like, I can't help but think about the Black Mirror as something that is in the way for the most part. You know, it's not connective. It's not, at least in these realms, it is not connective for me. It's not, you know, so much of what I do is not just about like whatever notes I'm playing at the time or whatever like squelches I'm making out of my electronics at the time, but it's about actually what does it sound like reverberating off the walls, what does it sound like being dampened by bodies, and having it kind of do that but not being able to translate nearly any of that through like a shitty phone speaker was kind of excruciating, actually. Mm-hmm. kind of excruciating, and I did it once and I would never do it again. You know, which was a real restriction on my quote unquote career, whatever that is.
I mean, what do you think in a kind of live performance context, what does sound do to audiences?
I mean, for me, and this is also why I play bass clarinet specifically, and I'm always drawn, you know, I'm a bass guitarist originally, and I'm a bass clarinetist now, and my electronics are all about like the kind of low end of the scale and the loud end of the scale. And that's a lot of it to me. It's like if what's happening in front of you is not like in some small way, at least like in your chest and in your stomach and in your throat, like as an audience member, then it's not like I've failed as a performer, but I've certainly like not given you what I want to give you, because I think there is something, there must be something bodily about music, otherwise you know it might as well be like MIDI, like essentially, and like that's great, and I used to make MIDI stuff when I was like 15, but I'm, you know, it's not what I'm actually interested in, and it doesn't send the right message for me. It disengages from the body in these really distinct kind of ways that I find really difficult to bridge, and I'm still finding difficult to bridge in a lot of ways.
I mean, it makes me think about how I still haven't, I don't think I've seen any live music still since the beginning of the pandemic. And, you know, what impact that kind of might have on people without kind of thinking about it, reflecting on it. I mean, do you think the pandemic has kind of transformed our relationship with sound, what we expect? Maybe we don't expect to hear live music anymore.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I went to my first performance, I don't know, a month or two ago, first performance since like first lockdown started. And it was weird. And, you know, it's actually, you know, you were like, is there a changing of relationship? And on some level, at least for me, like there's a kind of desperation to it. Like I was like, oh, I will listen to anything right now. I don't care. You want to play a weird homemade harmonium for 40 minutes? Fine. Fine by me. Like, you know what I mean? It was really like one of those things where I was like, okay, right. Like, I just don't care. I just want to watch a person like twang and bash a thing for a while and hear it like bounce off the walls and have that be it. It's like, in some ways, I think that it's made it more, I'm wary of saying like it's made it more like that the pandemic has made Sonics and like the live music experience more precious, because of course it has, just simply from the fact that like you would be very lucky to catch a gig, and it would depend on which city and country you live in, really. Mm-hmm. But like it definitely like does that. It definitely has a sense of like added both preciousness and precarity to it, right? Like there's a kind of like privilege of access to it, I think, also in some ways that I'm still negotiating. I'm still thinking about, you know, as someone who's living in a country that is like relatively okay in the grand scheme of things as far as the pandemic goes, like not great, but certainly, you know, in terms of the like vaccine apartheid that is happening now, we're doing okay in the grand scheme of things. And like, yeah, there's much to be said about like this idea of the normal and the returning to normal. And like, I couldn't give less of a shit about the normal. I could never give a shit about the normal, but now even more so. To me, I'm like, sounds Sonics as a thing should be permanently impacted by the pandemic. And anyone who wants to tell you otherwise, anyone who thinks that like at any point in time from now onwards, it's like just chill to go and like witness a bunch of people like creating stuff together, or even a single person creating something together like by themselves on stage, is like just regular, I fully defy that perspective. I fully like denounce that perspective, because I think it isn't like Sonics are always precious. It's just that in, at least in the society that we live in, it's, you know, blah 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 blah. You walk into a bar, you see some like rock band or whatever, and that's not happening anymore. And in some ways that's never been something that I've particularly appreciated about music. I don't give a shit about like cover bands. You know, I really don't. I don't give a fuck about cover bands. Except the Fleetwood Mac one, which I keep wanting to see. But like, aside from that, you know, I really don't care. Like, I don't care about the sort of like how commodified and happenstance our relationship to music has sort of become. And again, I'm very wary of making out the pandemic to be anything except a total global atrocity. And at the same time, it definitely has like refined the lens, I think, for more people to understand that music is something that like actually requires investment from the listener, actually requires investment from the audience, actually requires intention from everyone that is putting it together, witnessing it, and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point about how, you know, the pandemic is this horrible, destructive thing, and yet there are lessons and reflections that come out of that period.
Absolutely.
You know, sorry.
No, you go on.
Oh, just, I wonder about how much people will prioritize music going forward, because it seems to me it's not on the radar of a lot of people.
No, not at all. And I think, and I find that really interesting, right? Because I actually think that speaks to how superficial at a society level actually our relationship to music has become, certainly over the last like few decades, and certainly over the last couple of decades, you know. And again, this isn't me being like, oh, like, you know, blah blah blah, like hyperconsumption and this and the other, even though all of those factors are there, but actually the sort of like the fact that you don't even realize, like, you know, now I'm like walking through a Woolies and I'm hearing them say Woolies are fresh fruit people in that horrific melody for the millionth time. And I'm like, shit, that's the closest I've come to like hearing live music this week. You know, like truly, it's like one of those things that is like, okay, like, and actually most people walking through this Woolworths don't care and don't think about it and don't engage with melody. And that's, it is a kind of like unveiling of a kind of societal relationship to it. I think the music online is continuing at a pace. But as far as like people's relationship to like what it means to be present, what it means to also immerse in music past a point is like, yeah, it's kind of brought that into question, or at least it's kind of like shed a different light on that sort of relationship that we thought we had with music, at least.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. I think that's right. I mean, what do you think the future will be going forward, imagining that we can get to a kind of COVID normal point, a kind of post-pandemic-ish point? What do you think the future is going to look like around sound?
I mean, the grim answer is that we will not get music from the overwhelming majority of marginalized countries and low-income / highly exploited countries, because I don't know how the fuck they're going to get to COVID normal. And to me, I'm like, there is a deprivation there that people are going to start feeling if they haven't already. You know, like there is going to be, I'm worried about the narrowing of it, right? As I am with the narrowing of any kind of access to anything like that. Like in the same way that, like, I know that if I go to some crappy hardcore show, this is in the before times, like I'm going to see 12 to 16 white cisgender men sweating on stage because that's who has the most access to that. And like, do I give a shit about that? Not even a little bit. Not even a little bit. And in some ways, I'm concerned about this becoming the same way, because like, as always, the most marginalized people, the most marginalized places, the most underfunded groups and individuals are the least likely to be able to produce stuff. You know, it's that quote, I can never remember who says this quote, but that quote about how, you know, it's like basically like, why do I care about Albert Einstein when I know that like thousands of people with his level of intellect have died in sweatshops, you know? And it's kind of the same thing. It's like, actually, I don't know if I give a shit about some white person in Berlin with like, you know, mommy and daddy paying for their rent who can like, oh, wonderful, and a new electronic album or whatever, you know? Like, I worry that that we're going to start forgetting, actually, that there are so many people whose musics, whose sounds, whose like sonic cultures, we're going to really have much more difficulty accessing because a lot of them have died or will die or will continue to be like too busy keeping themselves and other people alive to produce music. And music thrives everywhere. Music thrives in poverty. Music thrives in ghettos. Music thrives at the margins. And at the same time, this is something else. This is something different. And so, yeah, I mean, yeah, my fear is that sonics and music as like, and sound as we understand it from like a global view is going to become even more rinsed and like controlled by like dominant countries. You know what I mean? Like the fact that I can like, if I like, I have a gig, I have my first live performance since pre-pandemic booked for next month. And it's like, that is only happening because of where I live. I have the privilege of going and sitting in a room and like getting paid money to make some tooting sounds into a licorice stick because of where I live, because of like various points of like literally like geopolitical privilege. And I again, like I said earlier, I'm still wrangling with that, right? I'm still wrangling with that privilege and what to do with that privilege and, you know, like, the ways in which I must forfeit things or I must pass things on where I can, even though I too am a pretty marginalized person in the grand scheme of things. Like it's still, these are some of the thoughts that I'm having. Cause it's like, well, like every other like person I know, like every other, like even in Australia, every like poor musician that I know is too busy eating shit, working two jobs now to make up for a lost time to sit down and write an album, to book gigs, to even contemplate some sort of tour or whatever the hell, you know? Like, it's like you see the bottleneck. You see the bottleneck happen with it. And yeah, that's my fear, right? That's my dystopic fear of a quote-unquote post-pandemic, whatever that means, sonic world.
I mean, I think that's a really good thing to highlight, because it's really about how the pandemic is exacerbating existing inequalities.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that's really important to remember. And in relation to the census, you know, how does it exacerbate existing inequalities that were already in the music industry, in the commercialized, in, you know, way that the industry works as well. And with particular dominance of certain countries. And it just makes that more obvious, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, we're actually like, again, I cringe at the notion of post-pandemic in the same way that I cringe at the sort of comprehension of like, that we live in like a post-colonial world. What it means is like, it's still happening, actually. Mm-hmm. It's still happening. We're still suffering the effects of it. We're post the point where it started. It's like, you know, it's like before Christ, you know, like it's like we're in the post-Christ situation. We're still in it right now. And it's the same thing with the pandemic. And like, yeah, I mean, I think that we're really, the thing is that we're really early in the piece when you think about, like kind of the capacity to have a sort of bird's eye view, I suppose, especially from a global perspective, especially if you're not just focusing on the global north, like we're really early in the piece in terms of the actual long-term implications that this pandemic has for sonics, for creation broadly, for, you know, whether it's for writing, whether it's for music, whether it's for performance. You know, actually that music series that I did a live performance for, I actually got to come back the following week, and it was kind of like a passing the baton sort of thing, where every person got to invite the next person that came on. And I actually invited my very, very good friend, Amrita Heppy, to join me in this kind of like a kind of artist engagement sort of thing. And we talked about it, and she was like, I'm not dancing on like Instagram Live. And I was like, oh, thank God. I don't want to play clarinet into a black mirror like ever again in my life. And we just talked for 20 minutes. We just talked about our practices for 20 minutes instead. And like, I feel like that's probably one of the few areas of sonics that I think are still relatively untainted by what has been happening. I think that speech and words are kind of like the few surviving remnants, I suppose, that are at least less affected when compared to like instrumentation and so on. But, you know, that was a really active decision by both of us to be like, you know what, actually, no, there's a degradation of quality and of substance when you don't do things the way that they're kind of like designed to be done. And I don't say that design is in like, because I'm a traditionalist. I say that because like my practice is one that it just doesn't, you know, you want to do a live DJ set on like Instagram Live. Cool. Maybe it sounds really great. You want to listen to one person play bass clarinet. Why? Why do that on Instagram? Why do that on a Black Mirror? You know, like I feel like it takes away quality and it takes away enjoyment, actually.
Mm.
And to me, I don't know how to pass that, right? I actually don't know how to get, past it. And I don't know how we will get past it until the whole goddamn world is vaccinated and we're through this shit. And until that happens, I refuse to have any kind of like determination to return to normal or to be okay with stuff or to like simply accept what I'm given, actually, in terms of opportunities, in terms of what few spaces I am given as a, again, heavily marginalized person within these spaces.
Well, I think that's a really interesting note to end on, thinking about these possible directions. And thank you so much for your time today, thinking about
sound. No problem.
It's been really great.
Thanks for inviting me.